Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or simply hoping to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and PsychReg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall.
So here we are, still at the International Conference on Psychology, Counseling, and Education in the Philippines.
In the Philippines, just a short plane ride from Florida.
The drive from the airport to the university that we're at was almost as long as the flight from Florida to the Philippines.
Just about. We had no idea.
I have never seen traffic the way that it is here in Manila.
I guess it should be about a 1 hour drive or less. It's about 50 kilometers, 60 kilometers.
Yeah, it wasn't even that. I thought I was told about 35 kilometers.
I thought it was 35.
Yeah, 35 kilometers.
Oh, okay.
It took us an hour and 15 minutes.
It took us three.
It took us 3 hours to get here from the airport.
Right. 1 hour 15. But we found a guy that was really good. He knew the back streets and kind of knew the shortcuts. So, yeah.
The streets, there's so many ways the streets just turn and divide. It would be very confusing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there's no stop signs.
Oh, that's the other thing. These four-way intersections
have
no stop signs. It's ever whoever has the most courage is how it works. And I was thinking, how would you teach children how to drive here? You know, if you have a 15 or 16-year-old. Although, I'm not sure if there's any limit.
I don't know what the age
limit is. Yeah. But and then you have scooters and other vehicles.
Oh yeah, the Indian kind of tuk-tuk thing that's like a Jeep, but we're all going to kind of probably do for team building.
Yes.
That sounds like a plan.
Right. Yeah. So we're here talking to. I met this woman as she was talking about Rudy.
As you do.
And I thought, how many Rudys do I know? Well, I watched.
I thought she was talking about the movie.
Well, there is the movie called Rudy.
Yeah.
About the boy who went to Notre Dame. Walk on there, and on the plane I watched The Book Thief, and the little girl who's the center of the movie befriended this boy, and his name was Rudy.
Yeah. So
that was in my head because of Rudy, but I couldn't figure out Rudy. I didn't know anybody here by the name of Rudy, and I couldn't figure out who she was talking about. At which point you turned to me and said, Giuliani. I thought, now I want to know more about this woman.
Yes.
So this is indeed a pleasure, except for the affiliation you have with the administration.
Some
of the people you hang out with.
That's right. Well, yeah. Have to work with them. Don't have a conversation.
So it's not a social connection.
No. Okay. I can count my friends on one hand, and those people are definitely not on my hand.
That's right.
Just get that right.
Okay. Okay. So we're here with Mandy Sangira. And she works with, you work with the UN.
Yeah, and I work with Plan International and Amnesty International. So I'm an independent consultant, but I work all over the world kind of talking about empowering women, talking about harmful practices, and talking about the ideology of abuse, and actually how do we change mindsets, and how do we empower youth?
Now, I know, because I heard them talking about it here with many students in the audience, many of them wanted to know, how did you end up with this kind of a, it's really more than a job. How does one do this?
It started 28 years ago.
How?
I started campaigning. I had a friend that had an impairment, an intellectual impairment, and her family married her off to somebody that came from the subcontinent and actually wanted a visa. And me being curious at 19, kind of started saying, well, why is she getting married? Because actually she doesn't really have an understanding of marriage, and why is her family doing that? And the mother of the daughter at the time was saying to my mother, don't tell your daughter to come in here and interfere in our life, you know. And my mum was like, look, you can't tell people how to raise their children. And I was thinking, but it isn't right. And what I noticed was that actually within weeks of her being married, she was a victim of sexual assault and violence, and was emotionally just drained, you know, with her awful, awful, wicked words. So I just thought, no, do you know what? I need to sort of step up and challenge. And I moved to BC in Vancouver and started campaigning. Beautiful part of the world, by the way. It's beautiful. And there was a real high population of South Asians there, but there was a lot of harmful practices going on behind the scenes, and nobody was kind of calling anyone out of it because of political correctness. So they were like, oh, it's their culture, their religion, we can't say anything. And I was thinking, well, hang on, if people are being forced into marriages or people are being abused in the name of honour, we need to step up and kind of call it for what it was. So I kind of ended up getting a reputation of kind of somebody that's never going to go away and is going to call people out for injustice. And here I am still, it's going to be 29 years in November, and I'm going to go back to the White House and kind of celebrate the anniversary like you do.
Like
yeah,
you do.
Yeah.
Yes. So that's a, it's quite a early introduction into this area of work.
Yeah.
And you've done a lot. I like the idea of referring to it as harmful practices.
Yeah.
Because it encapsulates so many things that are problematic in various cultures,
yeah.
Various communities, and so it's not just specific to one thing, it's talking about all of these harmful
yeah.
practices
yes.
that we need to address.
Better that they're called harmful practices than cultural practices.
Yeah. And I think that...
Did you do that? Yeah.
Yeah, because I think, you know what, people are a bit sensitive when it comes to culture.
Exactly.
People are very protective over their religion
mm-hmm.
and everything else. And I want to be very clear, these are not religious practices. These are out-of-date cultural traditions. And people that have never been educated. So, for instance, in Africa, like you said, there's like less than 20% of the people are not
yeah.
educated.
Yeah.
So some of the work that I have done last year with Geneva, at the UN, we talked about witchcraft and juju being recognised as a harmful practice. And I've been campaigning and sort of saying that this needs to be addressed. So in Britain, we will have a case. So we had one of Victoria Columbia probably sort of close to 20 years ago, and it actually changed the whole child protection procedures in Britain, because actually it kind of made people stand up and recognise that actually there are some things that are happening behind closed doors within certain communities, but nobody's calling people out on it. So, you know, sometimes good and bad are a part of the same coin, and we will all go through something really awful in our life, but we can't change that. So if you have a child with an impairment or autism or a disability, or someone that's just somewhat different with ADHD, for instance, it's very easy to blame that child for something that goes wrong. So if you lost your job today, that's because actually there might be no funding or they can't afford to keep you. It doesn't mean that your daughter is an evil spirit and actually she needs to be beaten because
right.
she's done that. So how do we educate people? How do you go into people's communities and actually try and change mindsets? And so you have to kind of involve the communities, and education is key. So we have to start saying to people that there's no place for this in the West. There's no place for it in the UK. There's no place for it in America or the Philippines or even in your own country. So what I found was that a lot of people were coming from all over the world. And because actually it was only till 1946 or something like that, we were still burning women and branding them witches in the UK, you know, and I'm sure that they probably still do in America. I've been called that a few times too, but hey, that's another story. it's kind of going into communities and educating people. So if you think about less than 20% of young people in Africa are learning their education from their elders in the community, and they have not had any education or any form of like education, so it's all cultural, and they are being told that actually when you're sort of just before puberty, a girl will go through the practice of FGM and be, you know, having that horrific practice, because actually they don't know anything. And those girls are being socially conditioned to believe that actually it's a rite of passage. You know, it's really difficult sometimes when you talk about these harmful practices, because these are not often done by strangers. And it's not like we're going to go out and be abused by somebody or have been a victim of an assault or something. These are practices being carried out by your family or your close ones and people that you trust. So it has been a bit of a difficult time at times. But then again, you know, I've never shied away from kind of calling a spade a spade.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
But I like what you're saying is the idea of we have to help recognize and bring awareness to some of these practices that think you're right that we incorrectly attribute it to, well, this is just a cultural or it's a religious practice, and you know, the reality is that these are harmful practices.
Yeah,
these are things that are hurting people. Yes, they're abuse.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no other way really around that.
No, there isn't. And I think sometimes, you know, when you meet frontline practitioners, whether it's social workers, teachers, nurses, or whoever, anyone in the frontline groups, and even psychologists, for instance, sometimes people thinking, oh my God, how do I deal with this now? Because actually this is really pushing me out of my comfort zone, and you know, this is all quite new to me. So I think that you know, the UN set up UN Women some years ago now, and so they are kind of raising awareness of these issues. And actually, we've realised that these practices are still going on. You know, one in three women will experience violence in her lifetime. You know, nearly half of young girls in, you know, the developing world are victims of early child forced marriage. You only have to go to America and girls are still being forced to marry their rapists. I was in Vancouver doing an event called Not Yet for the Dress, which is the UN campaign to end early child forced marriage. And Justin Trudeau's wife actually kind of screenshotted into the video. You won't believe this, Richard, today, but actually there was a lady in the audience going to me, Barney looks like Justin Trudeau, so I had to turn around and look at her. And I thought, oh, does he really?
No.
I just thought I needed to, might go to Specsavers, but I didn't think I needed to.
I still don't remember what he looks like, so I have to...
He is actually quite a good-looking man. So that might give him the ego boost, but Richard's like, no, he doesn't look like that, does he? No.
No. He needs no more positive reinforcement.
All right.
I think Richard's asleep.
Okay.
No, he's very much awake now.
But no, so... So even if we look at places like the US, where you are, early child forced marriage is an issue. Actually, child marriage is an issue in the United States, in some states. And so, you know, when we're coming into countries like the subcontinent or going to Africa and other countries where we can accuse them of, like, not being educated, how do we educate, you know, the West?
I think that sexual abuse is an epidemic in our country, especially in the Southeast. I think that it's routine, and I think it's cultural, and I think it's routine, and it's hidden, but it's a normal part of growing up for many, many, many people in our country.
Yeah. And I think that's an issue.
And I don't know how you get to people in our country, and as I listen to you talk, and I think how difficult it must be to get to other countries, Sub-Saharan Africa, parts of South America, Central America.
Yeah.
How do you, it seems like an indomitable.
It is, I mean, do you know what? And one of the reasons how I've managed to do that is actually work with NGOs, and I have to work with the governments and be very honest with them about why I'm in those countries. I mean, I have been very lucky to have traveled around this planet, God knows how many times, you know, going to places. And next year I've been invited to six countries in South America to go out and talk about such issues, because those issues are there. I've been talking to young women and they're saying, you know, violence is so kind of very common in Philippines, but actually women have no rights here. And if they want to leave an abusive marriage or a relationship, there isn't any real structures to support them. In Britain, a woman will stay 30 times in a relationship before she will ask for help.
30 times?
Yeah, if not more.
And there you have the social support.
And you have support. We have refuges. It might not be perfect, but, you know, there is support out there for you. I was in Sweden last month, and in Europe they have the most reported figures of domestic violence. And it wasn't that they had more cases of domestic violence. What it was actually women felt more empowered to go and report it. And so while I was there when we were talking about it, and it was really interesting to learn about the Scandinavian and the Baltic states at the time to see how do they deal with violence against women. And again, it was happening behind closed doors. Frontline practitioners know that it goes on. And they're like, well, and I was saying, but okay, so if a woman's getting beaten up, there are children in the home, is that not a child protection issue? Do you not have a duty of a care as a frontline practitioner or a social worker or a teacher or whatever you are to go into that school and kind of get social services involved, and they were like, oh, we've never really thought about it like that. We've never. And that worries me that actually, you know, we can blame countries like Africa and India and Pakistan that they may not have such processes in place. Mm-hmm. But it worries me that the developed world still has no processes in place.
Absolutely. And, you know, much to your point, we, in some of the clinical work we do, we have the opportunity to evaluate a lot of different people from all walks of life, especially those that end up getting involved in the criminal justice system, yeah. Things like that. And it's remarkable how many people, especially women, are victims of various forms of abuse, both as children, but also as adults.
Yeah.
And the rate of that abuse, I think it's just probably been one of my biggest surprises in all the work that I've done, because it's like the next one and then the next one, and the stories are just routine and over again. And again, even in a developed country where you
think we've had loads of problems in Britain where we've had high profile celebrities who have abused children for years. And I think it was Operation Yew Tree, and there was a TV presenter, sort of stroke kind of DJ, who's no longer alive, but actually was pandemic. He had abused so many children and nobody did anything about it. Everyone knew what he had done, but people were like, oh gosh, you know, how do we deal with it? Because he was so linked to the establishment. He had an OBE by the Queen, he was linked to Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister at the time, you know, and he used that power, because that's what abuse is about. It's about power and control over your victim. And in Britain, in recent years, there has been a real pandemic of... it was a lot of young children who ended up in the care system, so they're children that had looked after children, who have ended up being fostered, who have ended up... being victims of grooming. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's been a real pandemic issue. So again, because of political correctness, the frontline professionals knew that these girls were being abused and these boys were being pimped out across the country and being sexually exploited, and nobody did anything about it. And myself and Jack Straw at the time, who was the Home Secretary, was kind of raising awareness about this, and I kind of called it out for what it was. I was saying, look, these are Asian men from a certain community. I'm not saying that every man from that community is abusing children. However, this kind of grooming, picking up children in cars and exploiting them sexually, belong to one particular community. And we need to call it for what it is. We know that actually online grooming is predominantly white males. So, you know, I wasn't targeting a community. So what I had to do was go into that community, go to the Muslim Council of Britain and get them involved and say to them, listen, we're not going to stand for this, because actually, and I'm still here challenging them about it. And recently I turned up in a town called Telford, which is like a suburb. It's not like an inner city. So when we found out that hundreds and hundreds of girls had been sexually exploited by Asian men, but social services, again, it came back to, because of political correctness, nobody did nothing. So, you know, I mean, I know the media and everyone quote me all the time, but it's about being clear about protection and not political correctness. We need to call it for what it is. It's not child prostitutes. These are children being sexually exploited. You know, a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old is not a prostitute. She has been raped, she's been abused, so call it for what it is.
Absolutely. Oh, I thought you were going to ask something.
No, I'm just, this stuns me. Just, I mean, I know that it exists. I know that it exists all over the world.
Well, it does happen all over the world, and yeah.
It does. And yet, to hear the numbers, to hear the statistics, and to know how, you know, one of my slides talked about women, the increase in women scientists and professionals, and yet that's probably a very small minority, because most women are still victims around the world,
yeah.
I mean, including the United States.
Well,
for every woman scientist, there were, I don't know how many, being sexually abused.
I mean, you know, I mean, my family are from India and Pakistan, and, you know, from the subcontinent, and, you know, rape is so pandemic, and nobody wants to address it. So if a woman experiences marital rape. And people are like, well, it's not rape because you're married to him. You're not a property. You have a right to say no. So how do you educate people? So one of the reasons that I've been really passionate about is actually about educating young boys and about not telling girls what to wear, but actually teach boys about respect. That we change attitudes, that boys are not just princes and, you know, that they are somewhat superior. I was quite lucky, really. I was the first daughter, first grandchild. I was a spoiled rotten brat and actually probably been treated better than my brothers. But so, you know, and it's kind of given me a really strong sense of self-worth. So I kind of really sit outside the bell curve as a, you know, a South Asian woman of my age anyway. And, you know, because a lot of women have kind of followed the status quo and kind of just towed the line. They would not ruffle feathers. They will not challenge. And, you know, but I kind of think, well, I'm not here to be liked and I don't come here to make friends. I'm doing the right thing and actually my legacy will be my work. And, you know, if I save one child, I've done something. But I feel very blessed to have been able to support over 300 young people in my lifetime. And some of those people have had disabilities and impairments. So, you know, I feel like I've had an amazing life and an amazing career. And now I'm passionate about mentoring and supporting and educating young people and empowering them to lead in their own countries and kind of, you know, challenge out-of-date practices.
That's great. And I you know, we talked earlier with Fraser Smith,
yeah.
And we talked about what it means to be a man and what it means to be masculine. And,
yeah.
And I think that a lot of what your work is doing is some of the same,
yeah.
You know, defining what it means to be a man, but defining what it means to be a woman, that you don't, you know, being a woman doesn't mean that you have to be subjected to these things. It doesn't mean that you have to, you have a voice. We have to create some agency, some confidence, some security in these individuals, boys and girls, to make sure that they, you know, don't continue some of these practices that are damaging and harmful to themselves and to other people.
And I mean, Fraser's work is just phenomenal, and I think he's a great, you know, academic. He's doing amazing, amazing work. So one of the things that I've been really pushing with UN Women is now is actually about promoting SG5, which is about gender equality, and actually making sure that men are a part of the conversation. So we have the he for she campaign. So actually, anyone can be a feminist, because actually, if you stand up for women's rights and girls' rights, you're a feminist. So it's kind of trying to change that mindset, because when I was sort of trying to educate young men in from the South Asian community, the black community, for instance, they were like, well, I'm not gay. And I was like, this isn't about that. This is about you sticking up for your sister's rights, your girlfriend's rights, your mother's rights. And it's kind of changing one kind of mind at a time and actually doing global campaigns. So last year, the Day of the Girl, I did a campaign called I'm a Feminist, and lots of my male friends and people that I know stepped up and wrote about it, what it meant to be a feminist. Loads of young women stepped up to talk about being empowered, talking about what it means to be a feminist. And it was phenomenal, because we beat the UN, we beat everyone's records that day for Twitter. So, which is phenomenal. It just kind of really got everyone talking. But one of the things that you talked about, you know, in America about child abuse, you know, you being raped by a random stranger is really rare. Normally, we know our perpetrators. We know the person that kind of often abused them. So, you know, we've had a few cases where young children have been murdered in Britain, but they are very far and in between. So when we look at the figures, it's somebody who's befriended people, or they've kind of come in and do that. And one of the things that I'm really struggling with in Britain right now, I mean, obviously, just like America, you know, the first thing that gets cut is like therapy, frontline services, you know. And so, for instance, now, if you're a victim of child sexual abuse, so I'm looking at the Rotherham case again, so more the grooming, and we're giving people 6 sessions for 30 minutes. You're not even going to touch the tip of the iceberg there. And we kind of open a big Pandora's box and then say, well, off you go, and we're not dealing with people. And so I've kind of work very closely with government, and I'm kind of saying to the Department of Health and to the Prime Minister is, you know what? It costs thousands to get people into prison, people into being detained under the Mental Health Act, and people shouldn't be detained under the Mental Health Act. You know, they have been victims of abuse. They don't deserve to be put in and be institutionalized for the rest of their life. We're failing people. So how do we address those issues? And, you know, it's very difficult to get governments anywhere, even my own government, to step up and fund, you know, what is really needed support for victims of abuse. And, you know, and one of the things that really kind of hit a nerve, and I was sat in a courtroom listening to one of the perpetrators giving evidence, and he made a comment, and it kind of really touched me, and I kind of was like really moved by it. And he said, "You didn't, nobody cared about these girls. We gave them the attention. Their parents weren't interested in them. Social services weren't interested in them. The care system was not interested in them. So we had the opportunity to abuse them, so we did." I thought, you know, if this man walks out of here, I think I'd probably be arrested for assault. But, you know, he did get a real sentence. But, however, I was absolutely horrified. But actually, he made a really valid point, that the system had failed these young girls. They were vulnerable. They were not even, weren't even seen as a part of society. These children were like just, you know, like an Indian, like people, the untouchable, which is disgraceful. But however, that's how Britain saw these young girls in the care system. And we knew that this was going on, and we did nothing about it. So, you know, and again, it's about educating and challenging people. And we need to empower victims to take control over their life.
Is this about, is it more about women?
No, boys can be victims of abuse too. But however, a lot of sexual abuse that's happened and the work that I have done, 80% or 85% has been girls, and I'm not going to just exaggerate that, but that is the truth. But when I've done a lot of work with disability, because I've done some research recently with Nottingham University, and it's My Marriage, My Choice, and that's about early child forced marriage, but of people with disability with intellectual impairment. And that's looking at forced marriage of people with learning disabilities. And on that, it's really interesting, because it's almost half and half. So it's like 52% males and 48% females were victims of forced marriage. And the motivating factor for forced marriage of a disabled person was to actually have a carer. So it wasn't about controlling their behaviour. It wasn't about controlling the family honour. It was about getting rid of the stigma of disability, looking so-called normal, whatever that's meant to be, and getting a carer. So, you know, that findings were somewhat different. But, you know, again, I'm one of the founders of the UK Forced Marriage Unit, and that's a government unit, which is run by the Home Office and the Foreign Office. And what we do is kind of like work with NGOs, because they've got to do the work. They are the ones that are kind of supporting the victims. And it's easy to do preventative, because you can plan it and raise awareness and do that. But it's actually, okay, somebody's now been rescued from forced marriage. I've been to India and I've brought them back to the UK. You know, and then we kind of stick them in a homeless shelter because we've got nowhere for them. I mean, I don't know what the homeless shelters are like in the United States, but in the UK, they are full of people with mental health and substance misuse issues and people that, you know, have got very complex needs themselves. So if you're a 17, 18-year-old or a 19, 20-year-old young woman, do you really want to be going to the Salvation Army? Do you really want to be going to the YMCA or whatever service that you may have? So, you know, the services are not right. And then what happens is a lot of these victims end up going back to the best of the devil, you know, and actually will go back to family. And it is kind of like trying to work with very, very difficult constraints and often financial constraints.
Yeah, our experience is that once they've gone into the system and nothing positive happened, they inevitably go back.
Yeah, well, they will do, won't you? Because actually, if you've got nowhere to go,
they go back.
Yeah, so what do you do then? And that's really difficult. So, you know, like I've kind of been campaigning and sort of challenging because I'm one of the founders, I'm able to kind of, you know, influence a little bit more. So it's about having refuges. And then again, like a 19-year-old doesn't want to be in a refuge with a 50-year-old woman with a couple of kids and that. So it's about looking at transition, because some of these young people don't have the skills properly. It's like if you and I went away to university, you know, we learned to cook from scratch, we kind of learning to say, oh my God, I've got to pay bills now, because, you know, yeah, the reality of becoming an adult. And it's about, but if you've never been developed those skills, you've never had the independence because of culture and tradition, it makes them even more vulnerable. So it's kind of doing a lot of that work, and it's kind of really empowering them, and it isn't easy.
With some of that in mind, do you see, like, I'm trying to think of the, not really the chicken or the egg, but it's sort of a issue of, as we were just saying, you know, if they go into the system and then nothing happens, there's no place for them to go, then they end up going back. And is it an issue of having no place for them to go, or is it an issue for them not, for them not getting into the system to begin with?
Okay, so if they're under 18, they're a child, so the local authority has a duty of care to protect them, so they may end up in foster care, or they may end up living with an extended member of family who may kind of support them, but often we don't want them to go back to family because we realise that families will still put pressure onto the extended family, so that's not a model that I agree with and I don't, you know, advocate for. So local authorities do, but it's when you're over 18, you're considered an adult. You know, sadly, you're kind of put in the system just like any other homeless person at the time. And it's really frustrating because people don't recognise your circumstances. They don't look at that actually you're a victim of abuse, you're a victim of a harmful practice. And because it comes back to, again, frontline practitioners being not aware, not knowing how to deal with this, they don't know. Well, what do we do? You know, we don't want to upset community relations, we don't want to upset, you know, community cohesion. How do we deal with that then? So it is really difficult, but again, you know, in the UK and across the world, sadly, if we're making savings one of the frontline services that will go on, like refugees and kind of, you know, frontline services for anyone. So, you know, those are the kind of services that get hit. So it's kind of trying to find a good model. And, you know, Canada, I'm working with at the moment, we found somebody that was willing to build a transition house. Somebody gave us a plot of land and said, well, here you go. And then we've got builders that want to build and support you, but we need other countries to follow that model.
Right. Yeah. That would help, a place for them to go.
Yeah.
In our town, they can get shelter, but it's very difficult if you have children.
Yeah.
If you bring in children. Yeah, especially young children.
Yeah.
Your options are very limited.
And also, if you have like a teenage boy,
yeah.
A lot of refugees will refuse you in the UK because so you know it's very, very difficult. And this is why women will often stay in an abusive relationship. So like within the Philippines, in India, if you don't even have a bank account, you don't even have financial security, how can you be empowered if you don't have a choice, you don't have rights? How can you be empowered? So it's about kind of changing attitudes, kind of saying to women, you need to be educated. You've got to try and you should have your own bank account. Why shouldn't you? In India, more people have mobile phones than they do a bank account. Okay. You know, and that is really shocking. So we need the government to step up as well and kind of encourage women.
There's a lot of work that needs to be done.
Yeah.
In a lot of different areas. And you mentioned multiple harmful practices that are present everywhere. And I think it's an important point that you made earlier that it's not just third world countries, it's Western world, it's
like I said, in the United States last year we had one in Boston where, you know, 11-year-old was asked to marry her rapist. So you're telling me America's civilized?
No.
Okay.
Not in this regard.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, we have all of these problems exist, and I worry about sexual abuse within families in the South. I just think it exceeds all the estimates that we read about.
Yeah.
I have no question about it.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And, you know, it's not even just about the emotional abuse, but actually the physical abuse. And actually, you know, I've supported, you know, the NSPCC and so many other people. I did a big event with Esther Ransom, who runs the Child Line. And again, you know, children from ethnic minority backgrounds from the BME community. You know, child abuse happens in my community, it happens in the black community, it happens in every community.
It does.
And the problem is a lot of these children will not come out and talk about it because of culture and honour and isn't. I remember when I lived in Vancouver, there was a young girl that was a victim of a sexual assault. And I went with her to the police station, and oh my God, I'll never forget it, I was quite young at the time, I was in my early 20s. And her mum was like, oh my God, you crazy woman, nobody will marry her now, and you've ruined her life. And I kind of, being me, you know, wasn't very polite. And I kind of said, well, you know, what are you on? Are you on drugs or something? Because actually, your daughter is being traumatised, and you know that she's been abused, and you have done nothing about it. And she was like, look, nobody's going to marry my daughter. The shame, the stigma, we can't do anything about it. Luckily, there was enough evidence for the police to kind of prosecute that man. And obviously, because she was a minor, they were able to protect her identity. But obviously, people find out in the community, don't they? And people always, like bloody Chinese whispers, will travel. And that really kind of hit a nerve with me. And it kind of gave me even more kind of passion and drive to be thinking, no, I can't stand for this anymore. I have to step up and support victims in my own community and from the BME community, because there is nothing honourable about abuse in the name of honour and allowing children to be victims of sexual abuse. And, you know, your uncles come here, but we don't want to upset the family. We can't afford to upset the family dynamics, but it's okay for him to abuse you and rape you. No.
And they don't report it here, because if a woman has three or four children, leaves her husband, very little chance that she's going to get a job, because she has the responsibility. She can't get a job and pay for four children to be in school or preschool. So ours is a financial, it's not cultural or religious. It's financial. And they tell their children, if you tell anybody, you can't tell anybody, because if you do, we're all going to be separated. You're going to go into foster care, and we're going to all be separated, and you're not going to see mommy anymore. And so nobody says anything, and they get away with it.
And that is, you know, a pandemic around the world right now.
It is.
And, you know, when you see, like, a little child being abused at, like, two or three, and just kind of nobody is doing anything about it because they're too scared, and, you know, maybe I should keep my voice to myself, because I'm probably shocked at what I probably think I should do, but hey. You know what? It's been very difficult at times, but you know what? I love what I do. It's incredibly rewarding, and I feel very lucky that I've actually been able to go in and change policy. And one of the reasons that I've realised is you can't stand outside and advocate. You have to work within the system to make a difference. And I was very lucky that I was able to do that, you know, very early on in my career. You know, and it hasn't been easy because, you know, politicians and prime ministers and ministers have said to me, oh God, you know, we can't get involved in this, you know, because we don't want to upset the community. But I think, you know, they kind of knew that I wasn't going to go away either, and I think that they kind of ended up supporting me, and it's been amazing. I've been able to use that model across the world to do that. I mean, you know, like, I'm working a lot in Canada at the moment, but, you know, it's easy in Britain because the geography of the land is not difficult. So if a child has been abused in Manchester or something, you know, you could get there in about 3 hours or something, you know, and support them, and it's a bit easier. But actually, in Canada, you have different provinces, you have different states, just like America. So if we found out there was a forced marriage in Florida, but we're in New York, they don't even work together, of course. They don't work, you don't have the same databases, you don't share. So it's really, really difficult to do the work that we've done in Britain. So you can't model your support and your model based on the UK because of the geography of the country. Australia as well, because I've done some work with Australia last year with the Winston Churchill Foundation. They funded some research on early child forced marriage, and they wanted to take away some of the work that we had done in the UK, but they didn't think about the geography. and I was like, it's not going to work, because actually if somebody's been a victim in Sydney, and you know, you've got to fly across the other side of the country, and it could probably take you half a day to get there. So, you know, so it's about now looking at educating and empowering these communities, and then it's about frontline practitioners learning about sharing the data in an effective way, so it stops, you know, children and victims being abused.
I'm not sure I speak for both of us, and probably all of us, thanking you for the work that you do.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah, it really is impressive.
And you obviously have such a passion for it that started so early in your life, you know, when you were 19, and it's great to hear the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
So how can our listeners, anyone listening or following, how can they follow the work that you're doing or learn more about some of these things?
I mean, you know, one of the things is sadly, you know, that I have to use you know, a different mailing address to everywhere that I live, and that's a safeguard. But actually, Twitter, I do a Twitter chat every Wednesday, 6:30 UK, and it's called Empowerment Hour, so people can follow me on Twitter, LinkedIn. I have a kind of public Facebook page, and I kind of add people on there. Normally Twitter is the best way, because I promote when I'm doing talks and conferences, and normally kind of give out opportunities to young people to come along and attend events and things, because I feel that actually I want to empower the next generation. It's important that I lift the next generation off the sticky floor and give them real opportunities. And I'm so passionate about empowering the next generation. I need to be empowering the next lot of activists around the world to do that work, because I'm not going to be able to keep flying 14 hours across the world to be, you know, supporting people. So what I need to be doing is actually putting in the structures in the countries around the world, which I have been able to do for the last, you know, 28, 29 years now. And, you know, and it's giving them real resources, giving them real, you know, support. And, you know, and that's the only way that I can make a change, really. But, yeah, social media is the best way to kind of catch
them. And we have all those.
Yeah, I'll include all of those links in the show notes for the podcast and everything, so that they can follow
you
and take part in the
and we'll have to have you guys on to Empowerment Hour, because we can continue this debate about actually, you know, the trauma and the psychological abuse of, you know, how do we overcome that, because we don't. And then it's about actually kind of supporting victims and empowering them to take control over their life.
Absolutely, we'd be happy to come on.
Yeah, no, we'd love that too.
Yeah, we would. Thank you.
And Richard just wants to come onto Twitter, so he's going to say yes.
he will sit next to me as I work on my Twitter.
Okay.
That's the safest way to do it.
We're
trust me.
Oh, come on, we're going to let him onto Twitter just to come onto Empowerment Hour.
This is a red letter day.
Well, thank you again, and we will definitely have all the links.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing this episode of the Mental Breakdown and PsychReg podcast. Be sure to check out the show notes for links to follow us on Twitter and subscribe to our YouTube channel, where you will find all of our previous podcasts and much more. We would be honored if you would become a patron through patreon.com, where any donation you can manage will go to the development and creation of more content. Just visit patreon.com/themental breakdown for more information. Thanks again for listening. Have an awesome day, and we look forward to being back in your feed tomorrow morning. Thank you.